Good morning. I'd like to call the Finance Administration Committee meeting to order. Before you, there is an agenda. Are there any questions or objections to the agenda? Hearing none, we will move forward, approve as is. First are the minutes from the May 12th meeting. Is there a motion to approve the minutes? Moved by Mr. Giancarlo, second by Ms. Hines. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That's approved. We have two action items and two information items on this agenda today. The first item is the approval of the FY 2012 capital and operating budget. Ms. Kissel, do I turn it over to you now?
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So good morning, everybody. Morning. So I'm going to have Matt Brown take you through the approval of the operating and the capital budget as it appears now. And I believe Barbara Richardson, in the middle of the presentation, will take the committee through the staff report, which are the results of the public hearing, which you've received in your package. So I'll hand it over to Matt.
Thanks. Good morning. Again, this is to approve the FY12 budget that we've been talking about since it was introduced to the board and this committee in January. And there are three components, obviously. There's the operating budget, which funds our day-to-day operations, the capital budget, which funds our infrastructure improvements, and then reimbursable budgets, which are projects that are funded by jurisdictions or others that Metro completes, such as Neutral Host, the DC Circulator, and other projects. The first thing that, before I turn this over to Ms. Richardson, I'll just indicate that there were six town hall meetings. She'll speak in more detail about that. We did do a review of the Title VI requirements according to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I think what's important to note is, as a whole, the proposed changes in the languages there did not show a disparate impact on minority and low-income populations. And again, that was everything that was taken to public hearing. When we look at certain elements, particularly the E6 and the rail headway changes, for example, if those were implemented, recommended adjustments were not implemented, but the others were, there would be a greater impact. I think under the current proposal, none of the changes are included, so obviously there's no impact. And again, finally, at the end, none of the changes had a meaningful impact because of the few riders affected by the proposed changes. So then I'll turn it over to Ms. Richardson on the remainder of the public hearings.
We had a month-long input period, almost a month long, and customers and residents were asked to submit comments in a number of ways through letters, emails, calls, certainly in attending the public hearings that we hosted, and by completing an online survey. As you can see and have read, more than 4,000 comments were received. A particular note, there were two petitions in opposition to the elimination of the E6, and those were over 1,500 signatures on that measure. Next slide. For the first time, we did something a little different in addition to doing the legal public hearing process. We had an open house in which senior staff and members of the staff were available, as well as many of you. And we invited customers in to be able to have some one-on-one time to ask questions. We also had a town hall session where there could be a Q&A period, and we tried to respond to the questions rather than in a formal way, simply take the comments. More than 200 people, almost 200 people attended. 50 of them spoke during the town hall session. And those who spoke included the writers, of course, members of our Union 689, advocates, stakeholders, and I should note we also had some members of D.C. City Council attend, my own council member and Mr. Downs' council member Muriel Bowser, and also council member Che also attended these sessions. Issues that were brought to our attention, Smart Trip, a card, those that were particularly related to the problem that we've been having with the bus pass. So we were able to correct those and be able to respond and explain what was happening. Also, some related to the call center at the Smart Trip. With those Smart Trip issues, escalators, elevators, the amount of time being taken to correct and to repair those. Customer service, we had kudos. Shout out to Smitty or Dwayne Smith on the E6, who was commended by residents as an outstanding bus operator and loved in the Northwest Washington sector. And we also had situations that were pointed out to us of less than helpful bus operators. Indifference was flagged amongst some station managers, not that they were unresponsive, but maybe not as empathetic in addressing customer issues. Metro access fares, the complexity, understanding the fares, how they work, police presence, the desire to see more of our officers in the stations, service enhancements, system and service enhancements. We did receive quite a few comments on bus stops, for instance, suggestions on how to just tweak service to make it better from the customer point of view. So we'll take those, certainly are taking those into consideration. And general maintenance issues, you know, range of maintenance issues in the stations and so on. Next slide. Overwhelmingly, 83% of all the comments were in opposition to the elimination of the E6. You know, as I noted earlier, we also had the petitions there, too. In fact, so you'll see that 8 out of 10 of the comments that we had. 47 people commented that they did support the proposal. And then the second highest comment to take into consideration was the opposition to the increasing the weekend wait times from the rail side. And then thirdly, the elimination of the N8 received 55 comments in opposition to the elimination of it. Next slide. 832 people responded on online questionnaires. 46 of those percent of those were from the district, which is not a surprise because the bus changes were primarily in the district. I will note that the other category, in case you're curious, are those that did not disclose which jurisdiction they were from. Next slide. Briefly, you can just see here how the information came in on the survey. 42% of those on the E6 favored the elimination. So a comment about that is to keep in mind that the questionnaire is the entire region being asked to comment. So those who, it's probably a little bit of it's not in my backyard. So go ahead and eliminate it. And I don't have a breakdown by zip code, for instance, to see if it was in Ward 4 or in that section. But 34% said eliminate the K1. 54 favored elimination of the N8. Restructuring of the 70, 72, and 74 was favorable, and the rerouting of V8. Overwhelmingly on the rail side, the rail services, increasing wait time on the weekends was opposed. And again, another, because this, again, the survey was regionally, the Anacostia transfer eliminating that was favored, 44%. Next slide. We also took this time to ask some other questions. The board, as many of you commented, this was an opportunity for us to gather information on other policy issues, too, particularly the preventive maintenance. 60% of those who responded to the questionnaire opposed the use of operating for preventive maintenance. And we did, in the survey, point out the risk factor. of that and the federal funding issue that was involved. So there was an understanding about that issue. One-time revenue agreements, people opposed them. In particular, the explanation that we provided was about the leasing rights. So they were in opposition to that. 85% said that they would favor increasing local jurisdiction support. And in fact, when they were asked to rank the proposals that we provided them, that was the highest ranked one in terms of what they were telling us to consider, number one. Other suggestions that we received, we did ask about if we put on a small amount onto the fare, and we dedicated that to an improvement in a station or a series of stations. More than half the people said that they would favor that. Station naming rights, I think probably tested favorably. People are looking for lots of different ways to whatever you think that you can do to raise revenue. 67% favored increasing parking fees. Of note, 40% or 50, more than half of those who responded were from the district. But more than a quarter were from Virginia. And 49% oppose increasing fares, and 40% of those that oppose increasing fares were from the district. So that is my report on the input.
Thanks. So first we'll cover the operating budget. And the first slide walks us through some of the changes that were made, well, all of the changes that were made from the original proposed budget that the general manager introduced in January. Since that budget was introduced at revenue of $807 million, expenditures of $1.5 million, and then the subsidy of $644 which does include the $16.6 million in carry forward from FY10. There have been a few changes. On the revenue side, we increased revenue slightly by $4.1 million. The majority of that is an adjustment to rail revenue of 3.3. Our projections that we made in January had for the current fiscal year improved over the spring. I think the strengthening economy, ridership is greater than we had anticipated at that time. And it's a very small increase in rail revenue, in ridership, and then that equates, obviously, to revenue. The other piece is a minor adjustment, $800,000 that we received from the cellular carriers. So together, the revenue and picture improved by $4.1 million. Very small percentage increase, but does help the subsidy. On the expenditure side, we talked earlier this spring about the Metro Access cost savings, the $4 million, and that's included here. We made some adjustments to the overhead fringe benefit rates. Fringe benefit rates generally were less than we had anticipated, plus a slight adjustment to the overhead rate. The CNG tax credit is not something that we had anticipated. In fact, we didn't anticipate receiving what had been budgeted in the current fiscal year. We actually received what we anticipated in the current fiscal year, and we will receive $1.5 million next year. So that helps offset our fuel costs. There are four police department positions that were not included in the original budget. IT, there were some additional positions that were proposed in the budget. They were originally proposed under the capital budget, and we indicated to the board at the time that we would be reviewing those positions to ensure that they're charged to the correct budget, operating or capital. These relate to our help desk and our network operations center. We determined after review that there were positions, $2.7 million worth, that needed to be charged to the operating budget in order to meet GAAP requirements. We made a slight adjustment to the fuel and propulsion budgets, and this $1 million is a net increase. We reduced propulsion power by $1 million. We reduced electricity by $2 million and increased the fuel, which seems to be the bigger risk for our buses, by $3 million, so that's the net. We've made some minor labor adjustments. There were some headcount with regard to the parking initiative that were excluded from the original budget. So it's a minor adjustment of $300,000. And we were able to add two initiatives that I think are important to the authority. One is a bus recruitment program that focuses on pre-employment physicals, as well as a civil rights component reaching out to non-traditional populations to help us with our bus recruitment program. And finally, the addition of 10 elevator escalator mechanics to help with ongoing maintenance. This is a maintenance rather than a capital issue, and that's why they're included in the operating budget. Those changes together brought down our expenditures by $6.3 million, which leaves a subsidy of $638, again, including the $16 million in carry forward. And then we show at the very bottom line the $621 million, which is the subsidy for the operating budget. And just to note, if you're tying out numbers between the several charts, that does not include debt service. This is the operating support for Metro Bus, Metro Rail, and Metro Access. The next slide, please. This just gives some perspective on where we spend our money. Obviously, two-thirds of our $1.5 billion budget is on labor. The majority of our expenditures are on rail, about a third on bus, and 8% on metro access. By expense categories on the right, again, I mentioned that two-thirds of our budget is labor and fringe benefits. The services line, the $200 million, includes about $106 million that is for the Metro Access contract. Fuel and utilities, about $150 million, and then the other expenses are listed there. Next slide, please. And then this is where we get our sources of funds. Obviously, the largest cost recovery is on rail, and that's about 82%. On bus, cost recovery is about 27%. About 43, just short of 43% of the proposed budget would come from the jurisdictions from the subsidy. There's a very small cost recovery on Metro Access. That's also listed there. And finally, preventive maintenance has been brought down per board direction to the FY10 levels of $30.7 million. As you'll recall, in the current year, there's $60 million worth of preventive maintenance, and that has been brought down in the current budget. And finally, this is the reimbursable budget. We've mentioned before that the reimbursable budgets have been treated as an obligation basis, and the capital program has been on an expenditure basis. We're aligning everything to an expenditure basis. So these are the projected expenditures for the reimbursable. I'm sorry, these are the new budgets. The projected expenditures are explained later in the presentation. So for the DC circulator, it's about $21 million. For the neutral host, and that's the installation of the cellular carriers, they're reimbursing us for the cost of that program, just short of $12 million. Safety and security grants, these are separate from the safety and security grants that support the capital program. These support mainly our police department, primarily our canine unit. And then joint development and adjacent construction, $1.5 million, that's for escorts that are required for construction along our right-of-way. We're reimbursed by cellular carriers and others who need to access our right-of-way. And that's estimated at $1.5 million. This is kind of a small table. I'll point out the highlights. We began with an FY11 budget of $10,974, and the final number that's proposed is $11,313. About half of these positions have been approved by the board in various actions throughout the spring, mainly to support the neutral host project, which was $40 million, 30 positions to support the capital initiatives and procurement and the inspector general, and then the remainder mainly in what's listed here as operations, but really is our transportation infrastructure program. So those, I think, are the highlights. The 10 that I mentioned earlier, the 10 for the elevator escalator are listed on this page, and we've shown the total changes by operating, where there's a net reduction, and that's due in part to the movement of some of the activities in rail from operating to capital, which we've talked about, the overhaul shops, capital work that had been funded by our operating budget and now is appropriately categorized in the capital budget, 451 in the capital budget, and then 40 under the reimbursable program, and those 40 again were approved by the board earlier this year. So total increase of 345 positions.
Out of curiosity, I see three separate items on this chart that are reductions for overstatement in 2011 positions, six in communications marketing, eight in financial services, and 34 in bus. What does understatement of 2011 headcount mean?
As we've moved forward to make corrections and enhancements to our financial systems, the very first project that we tackled was our core financial systems, where we had several different systems that weren't well integrated, and the board funded a project to help us integrate those systems and to improve their performance. This spring, we will begin work on a HCM, or human capital management system, where we have similar issues. We have disparate systems, and as a result of some of the past coordination issues between those systems, we have not appropriately reflected the headcount in the budget. I can say that we have never exceeded the board authorized total headcount. This is a correction that we have been making in advance of implementing those systems, and is the appropriate thing to do. It accurately reflects and is an improvement to the headcount numbers that we presented previously.
Does that mean that there are 48 positions that disappeared?
That disappeared from the budget approval, but would still be in a system. I'm not sure I'm explaining that well, but the positions are corrected.
The positions weren't counted by various systems as a cumulative total.
I believe that's correct.
That's exactly right, because as Matt had mentioned, this is a very big system focus that I have been repeatedly mentioned about the integration of our systems. So what we've actually done here is done a very good, tight reconciliation of the source data. And so it's actually now accurately reflecting what is your reportable headcount. It doesn't mean you're adding new positions. These positions are there in these particular cases. Now we are reporting them. And the consolidation has taken some time, actually this whole year, to reflect that at the beginning of a budget year. As Matt mentioned, so we're not asking for new positions. They're just being accurately reported under this new reconciliation that we've done. So
I think I know what you mean.
Okay. Yeah, it's very and many other municipalities, and I know have similar issues where they have systems, your human capital systems, and then your payroll systems are very disparate, right? So they're not talking to each other, and we've made this great attempt to connect them. So I can assure you that we're definitely paying people who are here and they're working. That's true. that's a good thing. So now we're taking our human capital management system and upgrading it to making sure that as that happens, we are actually tracking it. And it's more robust than I'm talking about here, because really the consequence of this is you're managing your human capital. I mean, the robustness of this system will be you're managing training, you're managing career development, you're managing business development in one central repository that you're able to do that. So it's broader than the context here, and it's a good thing. But.
Thanks. Yes, thank you. Just one follow-up question related to that. We're really talking about headcount management and accuracy of data. But just to make sure I fully understand, in terms of tying that to the budget itself, were we overstated in terms of our of the budget for those positions that now we've corrected, or was that a separate calculation and we did not overstate the budget? Tie that together for me.
The budget was not overstated. The funds for those positions were included in the budget. Just the headcount was understated in the approved budget.
Okay.
Thank
now
you.
So the right-sizing.
Right. The positions were fully funded, appropriately funded.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Wells.
Yes. As we adopt this budget and say that we have, funding to do what we need to do,
our track record with maintenance and repair of our escalators has just been a disaster. And we've had some information, Mr. Sarles, that we need up to 55 new staff if we go with the paradigm of just hiring more staff to do that. And this budget allocates 10 new staff. How do we square that with where we've got to be to kind of get ahead of the curve and reassure our customers that we can run, we can maintain and repair our escalators?
Well, first of all, the $900,000 that I added before we had received the latest report, as that report indicates, potential need for 55 positions. However, there are other alternatives in that report, and also I have to take into account the silver line in preparing for escalator maintenance and elevator maintenance there, which requires training ahead of time. So what I have to do is take the information thus far. I've asked staff to do some more evaluation in terms of a contractor alternative, as well as how this fits in with the needs for the silver line, and then I'll come back to the board for a recommendation. So I'm not prepared at this moment, unless there's extra money from the jurisdictions, to recommend a change, because I don't have the precise recommendation for you yet.
But you do anticipate there may be a budget impact when we come up with a way that you can recommend to the board that we can manage our escalators?
Anticipate either in the operating capital or a combination of both.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let me ask the question a little different way. What we have before us is the 2012 capital staffing, and that represents what portion of vacancies that are currently programmed for this budget.
All of the positions indicated here are fully funded within the FY12 budget. Our current vacancy rate is about 8%. With the approval of these additional positions, that vacancy rate will obviously increase, although recruitment initiatives are underway in order to get these positions filled, especially the ones that are involved with the advancement of the capital program.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so then we'll continue. This is a subsidy table. I'll just point out the numbers in yellow. This information has been provided to the jurisdictions. The total operating budget, $621 million, and that ties to the previous page where we showed the subsidy. Again, subsidy is allocated to each jurisdiction based on the mode, and by mode, I mean the rail, bus, and access according to unique formulas. So that's $621 million needed for operating support. On top of that is the $16.6 million billed to the jurisdictions and currently due July 1 for the FY10 carry forward, which is a total of $638.2. And finally, there's debt service related to legacy debt as well as the Metro Matters program, which is an additional $48.7 million for total operating support, if you will, of $686.9 million. And again, this is the detail by the jurisdictions. It's been shared with the jurisdictions.
Sure. Two questions. In that left-hand yellow column, the total operating relative to 2012, $621 million, what is that number in 2011?
It's a $50 million. It was $572 million.
Okay.
$572 million. It's a $50 million increase.
Subsidy ask.
The total subsidy ask is $66.2 million, and of that, 16.6 is the snow carry forward. So it's about a $50 million increase in operating.
So our constraining of growth in operating expenses has really minimized portion of the ask.
And the increase is primarily related to, I mean, we restated our, we took a look at our revenues based on the fare increase, and actually we brought down our revenue number, and you're right, we held expenditures constant. So.
And the other, once we recommend this budget to the board and the board adopts it, these change from being an ask to an obligation, correct?
That's correct. Now we'll switch to the capital budget. And again, we've made great strides in converting all of our capital budget programs to an expenditure basis. So you see the multi-year CIP, which is the first line, the $858 million, which is our anticipated budget for FY12. This includes $89 million that was rolled over that was not anticipated to be spent in FY12. And then the FY13 through 17 program of $4.3 billion for a total six-year program of $5.2 billion. There are $100 million in reimbursable projects that will be advanced this year. Those are primarily Dulles at $34 million, the Glenmont Parking Garage, and there are some funds from the South, there are funds from the Southeastern Bus Garage, the proceeds from the sale that are classified as reimbursable under historical precedent. So that's what's included in the $100 million. We anticipate completing the stimulus program, $42 million in FY12, and then also spending out the safety and security grants that we spoke about last month in FY12. So that leaves us with a total FY12 capital budget of just over $1 billion, and then a six-year program of $5.7 billion. I would note that this does not include unexpended carry forward from the current fiscal year other than the $89 million that we've already rolled over. I don't anticipate that the full whatever amount that we don't expend this year will be just simply lopped over into FY12. We'll do some rational planning and put it in the years that we anticipate that we will expend those dollars.
And this capital program level represents basically a doubling of what we've been doing in the past, with all that stems from that in terms
right,
of
Right, in FY10, it's about $560 million. We spent much less than that. This is an increase in budget of about $300 million, but you're right, in terms of expenditures, it's about double. Similar to the operating budget, this shows our source of funds and where on the operating budget funds come from our passengers and from our jurisdictions. The federal funds that we receive, except with the exception of grants that are applied to the operating budget, are mainly applied to the capital budget. Clearly, 50% of the funds that we will receive for a capital program come from the federal government. There are the state and local jurisdictions do contribute in a significant amount, again, 20%. That is on top of the PREA match, the $150 million for the PREA match. Other miscellaneous sources, such as land sales, about 4%, and then the reimbursable projects that we talked about previously. So, again, the bulk is the federal funds that we receive. Anticipate that this will move to the board for adoption on June 23rd for our fiscal year that begins at the beginning of FY12. The budget packet contains a lot of attachments. It's detail on all of the expenditures, the revenues, everything that you've seen. There are updates to the budget book that we talked about in summary nature earlier in the presentation. So that concludes the presentation. Unless there are questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. And I think we'll open it up. And there is a resolution in page 32 of your packet. And what we will do is to answer questions and hopefully move forward with a recommendation. Mr. Nichols first.
Before we go to the general discussion, one specific question regarding the capital budget for the FY12. Could you recap again our effective spend rate from a capital standpoint of the allocated capital for the last year and what you anticipate achieving this year? In other words, how much will we be able to spend based on the new positions that we've authorized to accelerate capital expenditures and our overall efficiency at managing that program?
I comment some, and I'll ask Mr. Kubitschek if he has any additional comments, but based on the current forecast, it's $858 million, which is reflected in the budget. Our budget this year is about the same amount, and we know that we will underspend our budget. As of April, we had obligated a majority of the budget, $720 million, but only expended about half of that.
Right.
There are initiatives underway, and Mr. Kubitschek can describe those better than I, in order to speed the development, to speed the implementation of the capital program. And I just ask him to comment if he would.
Please, yes, thank you.
Yes, what we're looking at this stage is, since we switched over to the expenditure base, we do have a lot of larger capital project, line segment projects that weren't in place in the 2010-2011 process. So we do know that that ramping up of expenditures will increase. We're targeting there will be out the door expended, you know, probably over $500 million, you know, this year. But the key is that we probably got three or four other major projects that weren't in place at this time last year that will be big expenditures. The other component is that we've got a presentation later on in the Customer Service Committee that's going to be talking about outages and track access and everything else, and that's very key for us taking it into the next progressive step to accelerate.
So from a metric standpoint, part of our the systems you'll be coming back will be able to track and report to us on a regularized basis what our targets are for those expenditures and how we're achieving success against those targets.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, one of the things part of the capital process again started a little over a year ago is that we've brought in some consultants to help us with our financial reporting information, some of which is in this package or some of we've showed beforehand, where we're actually able to look at real-time information basically on a week-to-week basis almost at that level to really see how projects and stuff are maturing. Beforehand, we really didn't have the access at that level. So that in itself has been maturing out. And then the other component that's also very critical is they've broken it down is that the capital process as it relates to reimbursables, safety, security, and our ARRA funds, we're also standardizing those processes as well to make sure that we don't have different aspects of procurement practices or different confusion for reporting, and that will help streamline because a lot of the same resources have to touch these, you know, venues. Right. So if we standardize that, it helps push those things throughout as well.
Will the real-time reporting be implemented at the outset of the fiscal 2012 program?
Right now, what we're looking at, when I say real time, I can say that we're looking at it on a weekly basis where we're snapshotting information on every project that we have listed out, which is very, very powerful. And beforehand, we just, you know, a year ago, that didn't exist, but we do have that capability now.
Just to add, a year or so ago when we entered into the agreement, six-year agreement, we recognized that the ability to manage a large capital program had been dismantled here. And so at the same time that we were approving a much larger capital budget, we also, in parallel, began to reconstitute a capital program management discipline here, if you will, and improve the skills as well as capacity. So we've been running in parallel. And in fact, in FY11, while we did not attain the full expenditure projected in the budget, we did increase over the previous fiscal year at 50% in terms of our expenditure. We intend to increase it further this year as we continue to introduce a capital program management system here. Also, as Dave referenced before, and will be presented to the Customer Service Committee, we're looking at ways to get more productive outages where we, you know, use bus service. That will help. I also, in terms of looking at the amount of resources required to do it, in this capital budget, we did made some revisions in terms of how much work was being done related to the right-of-way as opposed to off the right-of-way where you use contractors and made some adjustments to also improve our ability to make the expenditure forecast.
Thank you.
Mr. Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on that, I just want to point the issue, and we'll discuss it later, but simply measuring expenditures is not a particularly good indication of how things are going. What we need to mature to is an ability to say, what are we getting for our money? Are the projects meeting their scope, schedule, and budget requirements? Being able to predict expenditures is critical in terms of being funded to pay the bills, but it doesn't tell us that the work is getting done at the rate that needs to be done.
Okay. Mr. Downs.
First, a specific question about the capital budget, and that is, does it include the $7.3 million of Metro Matters money?
Currently, it does. The January budget included that. And we have just received a letter from the district requesting the refund of their portion of that monies, which were unobligated under Metro Matters, And as part of the agreement under Metro Matters, those monies, if unobligated, would be looked at from a jurisdictional point of view to decide what use of them it would be. And the district has requested their portion back. So an answer to your next question would be, we are looking at analyzing the impact of what that would be to the capital program, and I think we have some alternate solutions so that we're not deferring a project, but we don't have that here. That would be something that would come in the next week to the board.
Well, I would ask that there be a specific report back about the reaction to Director Bellamy's letter on that request. The other is a more fundamental question about the capital budget. It assumes a significant number of capitalized positions to deliver the program. That number does not show up in specific detail, cumulative, in the capital budget. I think in terms of daylight and disclosure and accountability, that total number of capitalized positions and their total capital cost needs to be a specific in the front end of the capital budget so that it can be consistently tracked over the life of the capital budget process and that there be accountability for the vacancy rate, in effect, as part of the delivery of the program. And I noticed that in the monthly financials, there are currently 325 vacancies in TIES, and that's potentially a significant drag going forward on the delivery of this capital program and needs to be tracked as part of the quarterly tracking of the capital budget with the board.
And I agree. So there's a couple of things that we do currently. We actually, when we publish the budget book, by program, by each project, we develop a force account plan, which actually we have in place now, as well as a manpower plan overall. So the force account, as well as supervisor and project management plan. Those are being completed and will be published as part of the program. The second thing we do is, with the help of Parsons Brinkerhoff, is they're actually validating the manpower plan to deliver the enlarged capital program that we have. So they're tying the manpower plans to certain efforts because we do have overlapping resource and we have to actually schedule that resource as it goes out to accommodate for service delivery of projects. And the third thing I'll address is your question about the making that report very transparent and clear in our monthly report. We will do that. We have not done that in the past. We've just done it on a one-time basis. And then, as Dave indicated, we are now developing new, better project management delivery systems, one of which is the PMIS system. So we will take that and make sure that we actually report the manpower plan, which will go to the management of our manpower, not just vacancy rates, recruitment activities, but also we have issues with absenteeism and all other things that go along with managing manpower. So we will provide that.
And I guess location here, because while we talked about PNB's role in terms of the budget here, our last presentation talked about the not only the positions that were needed, but the ability to integrate all of those systems and meet that obligation. And I think, are we comfortable this budget does all of that?
I think we are comfortable that the budget captures all of our needs, a simple answer to your question. What our job is to implement that effectively and to do it in such a way that we ramp it up very quickly to do the service delivery, we track it, we report it, and we actually deliver the projects that we've asked permission to do.
And that reporting system from the PB process is the piece that we have as the opportunity to have.
Yeah, the PMIS system is a very critical tool for which we can manage too, or help us manage the delivery system. And it's a system that can actually do a lot in terms of reporting on the service delivery for due diligence for the board, if that's what you're asking. Yes, that can happen.
Okay.
A question as someone who's been riding the train the last couple of days in the 100-degree cars, I'll ask the question that I asked last year again. In the financial report, I was glancing ahead at page 196, and CIP 64 has the 1000 series rail car HVAC rehabilitation, and it's one of the third quarter system-wide accomplishments, completed 282 rail cars. So one looking at that might think that they've all been repaired, and certainly they haven't been. So my question is, in this new budget, do we have adequate funding in there to repair HVAC systems in our rail cars so that we don't have 100-plus degree rail cars out on the system, which is a major customer inconvenience?
We have completed the campaign of the 1000 series, the first initial phase, where we went through all the compressors and everything on schedule. At this time, what we have for the major HVAC work will shift into the operating budget process, where we have, you know, regular maintenance, regular campaigns on these areas. For FY12, there is a call for budget that we'll be looking at. Maybe it'll focus on the 5Ks because of the size of infrastructure that we were looking at to resolve. But we have, on top of that, we did complete a major campaign where we went through a cleaning effort and everything else that started in the February time frame and pulled itself all the way through the first part of April to go through all of the rail cars to provide an additional effort on that as well. As well as we're tracking our failures from this year to last year and monitoring also the temperature of that as well on performance.
So just to follow up, you feel confident then in the amount of funding and the manpower. I want to know this before we vote on the budget. The amount of manpower and capital money tied to doing that is sufficient to prevent the type of outages that we've had in the past. Not only outages, but the rail car I was in this morning had four seats that couldn't be used because the systems were leaking so bad that the carpet and seats were full of water. So what I want to know is, similar to the escalator elevator question earlier, do you have the manpower and the capital to have these air conditioning units in working order?
Yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Hines. Thank you. I'm going to move away from the specific and go back to the conversation we were having before about how we know that we're making progress. And it occurred to me listening, and it's been troubling to me trying to figure out, as we've been asked to approve additional positions over the last 6 months that I've been here, how can we have a sense of whether we have sufficient people, whether we're still on a building mode, and then once we get to where we think we're going, how do we compare to other transit agencies that are doing some of the same kinds of things? I think Metro has an extraordinary task ahead of it to get back to what I would call the state, what manager calls state of good repair. So I know it's not a fair thing to say we compare to others, but we need to have some understanding of whether, as we ramp up, this is where we're going to be forever, or, you know, what part of this is catch up. And so this is really a notion going forward. It may not be the perfect thing, but I think it's worth saying today that we ought to be thinking about some kind of a dashboard that has, in the same way that we have the KPI on some of our other major goals, that there might be a dashboard on both the capital budget and on the operating budget that would have some of these key pieces in it, and that might also identify some of the things that the board is most worried about. So that would give you an opportunity to tell us progress on a quarterly basis or some such thing like that on, you know, air conditioning or on, you know, other elements of the plan. So just a suggestion, but it would make, I think for all of us, it would be a quicker snapshot. It's, until you've been through these a number of times, it's very difficult to know exactly where you should look to figure out what the thing that you're concerned about.
So we report out in so many different ways, and I understand it's very complicated. So we report to the jurisdictions, we report in detail, we have, you know, more worksheets than, you know, you want to look at. But I think your point is a good one, that as the board has the opportunity to and responsibility to have this overview, right, making sure that you're doing your due diligence, you don't want to go through all of these reports. You want to focus on certain key elements, and that makes a lot of sense. Determining what those are would be something that we would like the board to tell us what you want to look at. And so that way we can actually develop some of those key performance measurements that are easy to read and that actually link to the service delivery of all the detailed reports that we do. Because the oversight, we have a lot of oversight bodies, not with respect to the federal government, to just our own internal ones. And I think that's a very good point, that we could work with the board to try to understand what measurements they'd want to look at.
Just to add, I mean, right now we have the vital signs report, which provides overview and measures a lot of things. To the extent that the board would like additional vital signs, you know, it would be worthwhile getting that feedback. But there is a report now that gives you how we perform on certain indicators, and we can certainly modify that.
Yeah, I think that Ms. Hines' point is a good one, and I think it's actually directly related to the next item on this agenda, which is really in terms of changing our delegations and procurement, and also to some extent we're going to rely on outcomes and accountability and using these reports as a way to measure whether things are going right or going wrong, since we're not going to get involved in the mechanics of how they're going to go about doing it. So I also think the other question I think that's important is whether we as a board adopt some of these vital signs measures as our own accountability measures for the staff and also to the public. A lot of these are internal right now, and I think that's great. But if we're going to establish a system of performance accountability, I think there is a question of the reports that we get and whether the board is going to adopt some of these measures to hold the entire agency accountable as well as ourselves when we adopt these budgets and also set policy. So I think that's a very good question. I think that's one we should engage in, and it's a very important thing for all of us to consider.
Mr. Downs.
I have to say this is one of the most frustrating and unfulfilling budget processes that I've been through in my professional career. It is incremental. It is loaded with incredible amounts of fiscal data. I frankly don't care what you give to the JCC or the RAC or the participating states and local jurisdictions. I am concerned about the right policy document for this board, who is the governing board of this authority. We tend to throw everything into the financial reporting process to the neglect of the primary focus of this budget, which should both be multi-year, but it should also be focused on what these dollars are intended to buy. The lack of a linkage to specific outcomes for our product is a almost total disconnect. I like very much the work that the general manager has done about the KPIs. I think they're very good. They're on a calendar year. They're not on a fiscal year. They should be the front end of any budget that we adopt, both operating and capital for the coming fiscal year, so that this board can hold management accountable for more than simply expending the dollars and measuring the revenue, but to measure specific performance on a quarterly and annual basis. This budget process cries out for a better statement of product, a rethinking of the annual cycle of the budget, which should start immediately after the adoption of this budget. Going forward, fiscal year 13, which starts, in my mind, in August for the prep, includes the first phase of the operating cost of the first phase of the Silver Line, and the year after that includes the full annualization of that cost.
a dialogue that we need to start earlier rather than later. And if this budget is any indication, we'll start that dialogue probably too late to avoid a lot of misunderstandings. I would urge you, both Richard and you, Carol, to think about the front-end performance that this budget is supposed to be buying and how we make this a multi-year process.
Any other questions, statements? Thank you. I think there are two things before we move to approval process, and I think it's putting the resolution on the table. We have gone through the budget, and with this is a resolution with the recommendation for next steps is moving to the board on the 23rd. Is there a motion?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Hines.
I would be delighted to put the resolution on the table as drafted and proposed to us for forwarding to the full board.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Downey. Discussion and questions.
Madam Chair, I'm very pleased about this budget. There's no question that everybody has worked tremendously hard to bring the right dollars to the table for us to make the right policy decision around for other previous decisions to return money to our capital budget appropriately and to avoid the service changes that we heard so clearly from the public were not in their best interest. And so I'm delighted to do that. I do have three amendments that I would like to propose relative to service adjustments. I don't know if you want those now or if
you... I think it's time for those. And board members can look, I think, in their notebook in the side. There are a set of proposed additions or changes to the resolution.
So you can
move forward.
All right. I have actually three amendments to suggest to the resolution. The first would be around new route 7M. Resolved that effective August 8, 2011, a new Metro bus route 7M is created to run between Pentagon and Mark Center from approximately 5:40 a.m. until 6:30 p.m. every 10 to 15 minutes during morning and evening peak periods and every 15 minutes during the midday. And be it further resolved, this is the extension of Route 3Y, that effective September 25, 2011, Metrobus Route 3Y be extended to operate between McPherson Square and Lee Highway and Harrison Street, and to add two additional runs, all to be paid for by Arlington County. And finally, this is additional service on Route 22A. I move that effective September 25, 2011, additional trips will be run on Metrobus Route 22A between Ballston and the Barcroft Terminal to service Arlington Hall. Those are my three.
Okay. Let me take Ms. Hines' additions and any, and I guess it's second. There's second for her motion in amending that. Second, thank you, Mr. Costa. Any discussion? Okay. All those in favor of those additions?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Thank you. Any other discussion? Mr. Downs, this is where you and Mr. Wells can tell us.
I move to amend the resolution to add the following resolved clauses. Resolved that the Anacostia special fare be eliminated effective September 25, 2011, thereby increasing the fare from $1 to $1.50 for Smart Trip and to $1.70 for cash on Metrobus routes 94, A2, A4, A5, A6, A7, A8, M8, M9, W2, W3, W6, and W8, as well as for stops at or south of Good Hope Road for routes 90, B2, P1, P2, P6, and U2, and further be it resolved that, coincident with the elimination of the existing Anacostia special fare, the bus to rail and rail to bus transfer is increased from 50 cents to $1 for those customers transferring to or from Metrobus routes 94A2, A4, A5, A6, A7, A8, M8, M9, W2, W3, W6, and W8 pursuant to an agreement with the District of Columbia as required by Compact Section 79. Further, be it resolved that I move to amend the resolution to add the following resolve clauses. Resolved that effective September 25th, 2010, the M8 Metrobus route is discontinued. And I also move to amend the resolution to add the following resolve clause, that effective September 25th, 2011, the K1 Metrobus route is discontinued.
Is there a second to Mr. Downs' motion?
Second.
Discussion?
Just a point of clarification. I have no objection to the motion. My assumption is that these are all routes that specifically impact the District of Columbia and will not have any either subsidy or adverse service impact on Maryland, and certainly fully support the amendments, recognizing that caveat. Mr. Downs.
I would confirm that these are only District of Columbia service adjustments.
Thanks a lot, sir.
I just wanted to make one clarification. That's absolutely right. And Ms. Hines is are all non-regional with the exception of one, which is the 22A. So we'll just make the statement that to the extent that you do have a 22A, which is a regional impact, staff will go back and look at how that impacts the subsidy. So it should be a very minor change. And we will develop those new numbers and provide them to the board this week after we hear all the amendments. So I believe most of the changes are specific to a jurisdiction and will be reimbursed by a jurisdiction, but that is the one exception, the 22A.
Can I ask which one was that?
It's the one that runs from Ballston to Barcroft and services Arlington Hall, which is a BRAC impact. The reason the service is increasing is they've relocated a significant number of persons to a place which had not so frequent bus service.
So so just with respect to that, Carol, you're saying that there may be some impact on the jurisdictional subsidy from the three jurisdictions? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's correct. And it should be extremely minor. I mean, it's a very minor change that should not severely impact any of the existing subsidy numbers that you have before
you. And by minor, can you suggest order of magnitude?
I mean,
minor is relative when we're talking about $1.4
billion. So you're talking millions. I'm talking of the, $50,000 range that might impact some of the, like for Maryland potentially, would be that.
Ms. Kissel, our staff says they don't believe there is a Maryland impact.
Oh, that's
a small impact for the Virginia and D.C. jurisdiction.
So your impact will be negligible.
Zero.
Thank you.
That's such a great answer.
Thank you. Couldn't ask for a better.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Wells.
Yes, Madam Chairman, I move to amend the resolution to add the following resolve clauses. Resolve that effective September 25th, 2011, Metrobus routes 70 and 71 will be shortened to operate between Silver Spring and Archives at all times and to reduce peak period frequency. Be it further resolved that effective September 25th, 2011, a new Metrobus route 74 is created to operate from 5 a.m. to 1 a.m. Monday through Sunday with service between Buzzard Point and Gallery Place, Chinatown, during peak periods Monday through Friday and between Half and O Street Southwest and Gallery Place, Chinatown, at all other times, with service delivery 18 minutes during peak periods and every 24 minutes during all other times.
Thank you. Did we do V7? 8? That was done.
We're not doing that at this time.
Okay. That's better. And that's a second as well to the original motion?
Yes.
Okay. Any discussion? Any discussion? Mr. McKay.
Oh, I was anticipating... Alvin, say asking. I think we need to know the answers to the same series of questions we just asked on the other two with those motions.
And you're correct, and I think we can affirm that these are the District of Columbia changes, none are regional.
That's right. These are not regional, and if I could just add, as a matter of discussion, that the 74 and 7071 that does come from Silver Spring down, it. That we have assurance from the very able Mr. Hamry, that if it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't bring about the intended results, that it's something for no cost, no fiscal impact, we can go back to the old way of doing it. If there is an unintended impact, that but.
Could you restate exactly what the modification being proposed is?
Yes, in terms of the 7071, is that they broke the, used to go from Silver Spring all the way down to the bottom of Buzzard Point, and so they've created two lines so that you have less bunching. There's a lot of problems with these buses staying on time because it goes through the heart of the city. So they broke it up, and by breaking it up, they looked where most of the riders terminate, and so to try to create the minimal impact, but at the same time, to be able to create more on-time bus service and for it to be, again, less bunching and all that to improve the service. There's been a lot of complaints about this route.
Any other questions about impact of subsidy? Mrs. Porter?
I was just going to just clarify. So at the Silver Spring end, there's going to be no change?
That's right, except it won't go all the way to Buzzard Point.
Okay. Any other questions? No other discussion. All those in favor of the motion and substituting those into the resolution?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Any other changes? Any other discussion here? Yes, Mr. Downs?
A minor operating budget motion, and that is that in the DC circulator account, there carried an amount of estimated surplus because of some favorable financials of about $980,000. Instead of carrying that forward as part of the DC circulator account, we would like to have that be a payment made directly to Metro as part of the district's operating subsidy payment.
I'm going to ask staff to give me an opine on that one. Yes.
Yeah. Manager, could we get, for an understanding of this, an indication from the staff as to what actions we are not taking that have been discussed?
So that's a good conclusion of this motion. On the question of the circulator, I want clarity that we have actually two actions that the DC will be taking relative to this budget, and that is now the 900 circulator and the same number again of the Metro Matters.
Yeah. We can, so
we're going to come back and
respond back to Mr. Bellamy because okay. I think that was in the request as well.
Good.
Okay. May we have a? I guess I haven't seen those requests, and I think it would be good that we all shared those requests from the District of Columbia.
And I apologize. We actually just received a letter a couple of days ago, and we have a response that's going back to the board, as we normally do, notifying the board as a whole what the request is and what our response will be. I mean, you should be having that today.
And I think maybe we also have the policy statement that we've had as a board regarding the return of funds back to the jurisdictions.
Yes, we can include that in the response, but typically if it's a jurisdiction can make the request, if it's a reimbursable funds on account, if you will, to redirect it. In the past, it has been brought to the committee as a whole just as a notification.
Right.
It has not required approval, but just almost as a notification. So we'll provide that in the letter.
Ms. Hines.
Madam Chair, I just to go back to our change in Virginia, I've been informed that it's a $5,000 cost total. So it really is a rounding error on
that. That was $45,000 less than I thought it was.
All righty. So we have before us a resolution with the proposed changes. Any further discussion?
I would like an answer to my
I'm sorry. Please restate it.
I'd like to state for the record
things
that we are not doing that have been discussed
things
as part of the budget process.
Part of the docket.
Yeah, part of the docket.
You want that within the resolution?
Do you want it in the resolution, or do you want it as a
statement
of the record?
No, I want it on the record now.
Statement of the record
as
to what we will not do.
Late night service, that we are not eliminating certain routes, that we are going back to the historical level of preventive maintenance allocation and anything else that I've forgotten.
Yeah. Oh, we're not selling
reserves.
Yes, right.
Just to give us a minute.
I think you stated them well. Never mind.
So we're not doing the rail service. Okay, so so based upon the amendments that were brought by the committee to the floor, as a result of the staff report that were provided by the public hearing, the things that we will not be including in, we will not be eliminating, I should say, will be, first and foremost, we will not be widening Saturday and Sunday headways on the rail service. We will not be eliminating the E6. And we will not be extending the M4 route. We will not be rerouting the V8. And that's it.
And from the budgetary standpoint, we will not be, we'll be reducing the amount of capital funds used for preventive maintenance. We that's will correct. Not be doing one-shot sales of property.
That's
this
correct.
Is basically a fundamentally sound budget that lives within the resources that are available in the year in which we're incurring expenses.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, all those in favor of the motion that's on the table?
Aye.
And those opposed? The motion carries, and I want to say thank you to staff for the work that they've done and communications with our customers during the town meeting and the public hearing. I think, as Mr. Downey noted, this budget represents, I think, a form of sustainability in terms of how we wish to, one, generate our revenue and expend those funds based upon that and that clear planning. And I think part of that is a recognition of the jurisdictional roles of coming forward with the subsidy needs for the budget as proposed by the general manager. I think it also reflects the work of the staff in finding and identifying reductions within the administrative aspect of the authority. And I think hopefully it gives our customers the confirmation that we take safety and the role of good repair as part of the value system of what this budget is about today. I think it was a difficult budget last year in terms of the amount of increase that we placed upon our customers, in addition to, I think, the philosophy of using a one-time funding in order to close the budget. And this budget is the reverse of both of those. And I think it is a reflection of the work of the board and the jurisdictions that really believe that our customers really need to see the investments that they, as well as we, are making, and that the services can, through the work of the capital budget, and the work of our staff in addressing the safety issues and security issues represents our commitment to maintaining Metro in truly the kind of system that this region has come to depend upon. So I want to thank everyone for the work that they've done. Staff, I would ask that we get the changes out as quickly as possible so everyone can come back on the 23rd prepared with those numbers understood that may reflect some possible adjustments here. But I think it is a good news piece that I think I'm really glad to have worked with everybody in getting us to this point on this. So thank you all.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I just want to associate myself with your remarks that this has been a good outcome. The staff has been very supportive. The board has worked well. The jurisdictions have worked well. But we can do better, as
we have work ahead of us.
The next round could be even better for us.
And the next item before us is one of those that we can move forward on. I appreciate that, Mr. Downey. Mr. Downey's comments are not unheard, and I think we are moving toward that. The next item on the agenda is the approval of a procurement and contracting policies and procedures. This item comes to us, I think, also in the reflection of the kind of changes that we want in order to implement the capital program and implementing that capital program in a reflection of the agreements that we've had with the jurisdictions on bringing dollars to the table, implementing the projects, moving them through with the authority of the general manager being able to do so. Staff will walk through the presentation, but I think there are two aspects of this. One, the opportunity to make some changes to the general manager's authority, but with that, the need to find the accountability and transparency as to how that will be implemented and how the board's oversight role will be performed in this. Ms. Kissel.
Great, and thank you for that introduction. That's exactly what this next presentation will discuss. So you can go to this chart here as a little bit more background and purpose. The Metro's FY10 last year's capital budget was $560 million. And this current year, in fiscal year 11, is increased by $300 million. Primarily by the PREA funds that we received, the dedicated funds from the federal government and the local mats from the jurisdictions. So this funding increase actually has led to about a 20 to 30% more contracting activity that we have to support. And it goes directly to the infrastructure that we need to put in place in order to do the service delivery that's dictated by the capital program. So that increase in activity means a lot more work by project managers, its force account staff, its track workers, Metro's administrative staff, all are involved in the capital implementation program. And at the same time we're increasing the capital work, we are also very cognizant and aware of becoming more transparent in our reporting obligation to not only the board, but to jurisdictions and to other oversight bodies, federal government for one, FTA, that we need to, we continue to be transparent and we continue to derive reports that are meaningful to that body of people. Some of new procedures were implemented this year as a result of the new capital funding agreement that was put in place. For some of the new board members, we had a six-year Metro Matters funding agreement, which ended last year, and there's a group of folks, staff, and the jurisdictions worked hard to put together a new capital funding agreement. We moved from obligation to expenditure-based, was the biggest move that we made, but in that capital funding agreement, there are very restrictive requirements regarding accountability and transparency obligations by the staff of Metro to report monthly, quarterly, and doing annual work plans that represent not just the expenditure, but also the delivery of the capital program. So those internal controls are in place currently in the capital funding agreement. In addition, as you know, we have mentioned this several times, and you have seen Parsons Brinckerhoff has been here for the last 8 months, and they have been establishing service delivery controls, what I call people, process, and technology, right? Staffing up those areas that which we need as infrastructure to deliver the capital program. In addition, we are modifying the way we look at our supply chain management. This goes to the capital delivery, goes to materials and supplies that you need to implement a very large capital program. So we're looking at the supply chain management, how we procure goods and services effectively in order to deliver. And as we review the internal processes, there's two specific areas that we would like the board to consider. And these I'm going to talk a little bit about. One is the awarding, delegation of the award of contract awards, and the other is the reprogramming of the capital budget. So that's the background and purpose. If you go to the next chart, the goal is to accelerate the RFP process, basically. And said another way, accelerate the ability for us to procure goods and services to deliver our capital program. And enhancing our internal controls and processes in such a way that the board has the ability to understand and provide due diligence as part of their responsibility, your responsibility, to feel comfortable that those things are being done. On the next page, We actually, I wanted to talk about what our existing policy is, just to give you a framework for what that is. I won't go through this step by step, because I think you've had a chance to look at it, but it does give you the delegation abilities that are in place now. Pretty much, when you look at this, 90% of the actions that we take, the contract actions that we take, we come to the board for, 90%. And the request here is to delegate that activity to the CEO and the general manager in such a way that any actions that are taken by the CEO, the general manager, are still being reported to the board on a timely and a regular basis and are in the consist of the six-year capital program. So if you look at some of these delegations here, the just a couple years ago when I came here, we actually attempted to streamline the procurement policies and procedures, and we had done that with the board in such a way that we actually would come to the board with a plan of contracts at the beginning of the budget year. And on that plan of contracts, we would have listed operating and capital contracts. However, if you did not make that time frame, that you did not have your operating plan or contract capital or operating on the list that was approved by the board, that would then kick off and trigger a series of regular monthly meetings at these meetings that we would actually ask the board for permission to initiate and then ultimately award other contracts that were not in that. So poor planning on our part. And the streamlining procurement that we did a few years ago was to get as much in the plan of contracts as we possibly could in order to have that approval day one at the budget. It actually really just allowed for a single opportunity, and it did not reduce the initiate and award of contracts that would go to the board throughout that year. So we still had 90%. Or a lot of percentage of contracts and activities that were still going before the board on a regular basis. So the with the advent of the increased capital budget, we just have a lot more activity that would be going to the board. And the recommendation from staff is that the board should be looking at this from a policy perspective versus an operation perspective. And the delegation is looking to make the board comfortable that they can delegate to the general manager with regard to moving to initiating and work contracts, but still allowing the board with their obligation from a due diligence perspective to ensure that what was planned is being done. And that's what this delegation is about. If you go to the next chart, and skip that one and go to the next one. Well, actually, go back to that other one. I wanted to make a point on this other chart. We currently have a procurement policy manual which we're in the process of revising. I've said this in the past, that it's a very large document that has a lot of procedures about how to contract with Metro. We're trying to make it more user-friendly. I call it the 600-pound doorstop because it really should be more effective than that. So PB is helping us do that, and we're parsing that procurement policy manual in such a way that it's going to be three sections. One is something very clear and concise that shows what the rules are for any contract or initiating award, and this is going to be used by project managers. Then there's another section that talks about what procurement contract officers need to do to include in contracts, terms and conditions and those things. And then the third part will actually be the delegation from the board to the general manager, ensuring that those reporting requirements are kept in place. So in terms of reporting requirements, we go to the next chart. I wanted to give you an understanding of some of the guidelines that we operate under now. Primarily, we use the Authorities Compact to guide us anytime we issue contracts and awards. That's a given, and that is a primary authority and governing document that we use. We also abide by federal laws. Circulars by the FTA that we have to abide by with regard to how to use funds for eligible projects and what is eligible for federal funding. We are also guided by our own Inspector General in terms of sole source procurements, competitive agreements, and looking at cost and pricing as we do contracting. And we're subject to annual audits. The triannual annual audit we just went through with the federal, the FTA, and they go through that audit. Actually, they go through our procurement policy. They take a random look at some of our contract files to ensure that they have all the required information to initiate a contract. And so we pass those on a regular basis with no real material findings. And then additionally, we have reporting that we do through our new capital funding agreement. So our new capital funding agreement requires that I report on an annual work plan basis. I also report on a quarterly basis, contract initiations and service delivery. And then we also report, we will be reporting in the future a little bit more detailed, based upon your comments, Mr. Downs, on a monthly report in terms of where we are, not just expenditures, but service delivery. And in the past, we have included contract information in those monthly reports. We also report on small and disadvantaged business requirements. We report on our DBE goals that we have in terms of our contract requirements and the performance if we're meeting those goals on a regular basis. And we also have procurement metrics that we look at. What's the cycle time of getting a contract out the door? Currently, it's extremely long. It takes, on average, 180 days and sometimes longer if you have a lot of complications in a contract. So the purpose of delegating to the general manager is not to move away from transparency and accountability, but it's an ability to cut down the cycle time on providing that information, actually cut down the cycle time on actually approving, initiating awards, and moving the business through the system more effectively than we do now. And it gets the board out of the operating business, if you will, and it puts the board really squarely in a policy-making body, which is what I have been, we all have been hearing the last, you know, several months as you go through your governing guidelines. And that's the purpose of this delegation.
So may I interrupt you, Mr. Nichols?
Yes.
Yes, just a quick question. Thank you. That's a great introduction, and I don't want to divert the discussion from the specifics of improving operational practices, but with respect to the board's or the Metro's policies with respect to small local disadvantages, disadvantaged businesses, MBEs, CBEs, whatever the criteria is, would you just take one moment and speak to what WMATA's policies and are with respect to procurement and small local disadvantages? Because one of the questions that comes to me periodically is, does WMATA have procurement policies with respect to small local disadvantaged businesses, et cetera? And I think it's important for us to make sure that that's clear to the public and to the business community, and particularly if we're talking about streamlining and improving the efficiency of the process.
Yes, thank you. And we do. We have a board-approved a policy with regard to DBE, disadvantaged business enterprises, where we actually look to meet the goal of 25% in many of our solicitations. And so, great, thank you. So Heather Obora, I'd like you to introduce, and many of you know Heather, is our chief procurement officer. And actually, she can speak to the DBE and as a local disadvantage.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Heather Obora. I'm your chief procurement officer here at Metro. We currently do have DBE goals set at 25% for our federally funded solicitations that we run. We also have preference goals set for small and local business participation under the board-approved small and local business program. We have two separate departments, one that runs the DBE side, which is more federal. We coordinate on certifications and such with the DC Department of Transportation and other agencies for certification purposes. On the small and local business, they can self-certify, so we do a cursory review of their self-certification and make sure that they're acceptable, and then put them into a category of small and local business participation for anything on the operating side, operating funded. Currently, we're running at about 25% also in that program on parts participation. We get a little higher than that because we've got a lot of more smaller local distributorships and businesses that we can do business with. We have outreach programs for both. So we do have someone on the small and local business program that does work with chambers, you know, the chambers of commerces and then the states, and making sure that we're tying into what the state approved small and local business rules and regulations are, and that we're matching that as well.
Okay, thank you very much. I just wanted to bring that into the discussion as a, as part of the background.
Thank you. Great.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just to follow up on that, the federal procurements do not permit local preference, but they very strongly encourage DBE, and my belief is that the DBE goal that this agency sets is among one of the highest in the country. The federal expectation, although it's not a mandate or a quota, is 10%. We're achieving, setting and achieving 25%. And the local preference, as I understand it, is for those funds that are not federal funds, but we have that authority.
That is correct.
Moving on to Heather. Moving on to the second aspect. Stay here, Heather. No. So moving on to the second request here is actually the ability for the board to delegate to the general manager the reprogramming aspect of the procurement process. And I want to take a little moment to discuss what that. So as you can see here, the reprogramming actions for the board under the, this is under the existing programming policies, and we put what the element is in terms of what the action would be, what the existing policy here is, and on the left, right-hand side is what the recommended policy would be. So currently, we actually approve an annual budget, but we also give a six-year capital improvement program, which is very detailed, but we approve an annual work plan just for that particular year in terms of funding. The creation of any new capital project that is outside the boundaries of the annual year, as well as outside the boundaries of the six-year program, would still be under the responsibility of the board, that we would go to the board and it would require approval before that action was done. And we're recommending that we keep that in place. One of the things that we don't want to do is move a new project into a program when it's actually not within our annual or six-year CIP without having any type of discussion or approval from the board. The second item is the amendment that increases the capital budget. If there is a requirement to increase the funding cap on an annual basis, we would obviously go back to the board to get approval for that. And we're recommending that that stay in place.
Yes. This is a very low-level question, but a new capital project, specifically define what a capital project is.
Okay. So a capital project, we have about we look at a capital project and we categorize that as a program. So it has a CIP number. It's a capital improvement program. Let's take rail rehabilitation, or which is a CIP program. Under that capital program, there's a scope of work that defines what rail rehabilitation is under that CIP. And it talks about all the line segments that we have within the network that we have to rehabilitate. So under that program, there can be several project activities which coincide with that scope and mission of the CIP. It cannot divert from that scope and mission. You cannot put a activity that would not be considered under rail line segment rehabilitation.
Madam Chairman, could I ask another question, Ms. Kissel, mm-hmm. because you said it twice, and I want to be sure I understand it. You said either within the one-year adopted plan or in the six-year plan.
That's correct.
And so something is funded at zero mm-hmm. in 2012, but in 2014, it's got some money programmed. Mm-hmm. If you decide, staff decides, that really we need to spend money now, where we said zero, we're going to advance that project. Does that come back to the board, or if it's in the six-year plan, it doesn't have to come back to the board?
So it's a great question, and I'll answer it, and I'll jump right to where we get to the 5%, which is in the middle of that page. The scenario that you just laid out is an interesting one, because although we have to do two things. We have to spend our money, and we have to deliver projects. And a way to do that is there's times where you may have projects that are funded in an advanced year. And you may have a project in your current year that's being delayed for environmental reasons, you know, out of your control, whatever. We are requesting the ability of the project manager. I know you don't. We're requesting that the board consider providing the CEO with the ability to reprogram up to 5% of the annual budget. So if you have an $850 million budget, he can reprogram up to $40 million in that year for the scenario that we just painted. So if he sees that there's a slow project for $40 million, it's not going to happen, and it's in your annual program, the ability for him to advance a project that's in a future year program that year up to a cap of 5% is the request that we're making, because it goes to the heart of the issue, spending our money effectively as well as delivering what we promised to deliver. The caveat is that it has to be within the six-year program. It cannot be a new project that has been identified. That would always come to the board.
Let me start with Mr. Acosta.
Yes, thank you. How was the 5% threshold determined? Is that best practices, or is this based on another best practices of other agencies? Sure. I'm a curiosity. How was that determined?
My judgment is what it came down to. Okay, there you go. I felt there needed to be some flexibility for the general manager to have it, but I thought it also should be limited. I didn't want, of course, I wouldn't do it, but a future general manager, you know, having unlimited ability to squirrel up the whole capital program. So this gives me some flexibility that when I see things are not going as quickly as on one project, to bring another already authorized project up and advance it so we continue to make improvements and not defer things out.
That's a further question on the 5%. Mm-hmm. As I understand it, that's the cumulative total of changes that have been made?
Yes. Yeah. In other words, once I hit $40 million, I have to get back to the board.
But, again, not suggesting it would happen, a change of $40 million to add $40 million to a $1 million project could conceivably be a reprogramming.
I guess it could be, but that would also say to me that if you went from a $1 million really project to a $40 million project, that's a new project.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, and let me make a further clarification on this, because before we got here, as I referenced the capital funding agreement, which is the document that we actually are required to abide by, and we do, in that document, it indicates that any change over $1 million in the program, we have to notify the jurisdictions, the board, that change is being made. So regardless of the cap that we're recommending, any change, in the example that you just gave, over $1 million would have to be notified. And the board would have the ability to ask questions and obviously, you know, do their job in terms of requesting more information regarding that change. So that would not stop.
Just Madam, one, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to kind of think of each of those that we've talked about, so because I think this goes back to ensuring the transparency as well as the accountability for the board. So we are speaking of a capital program that we have adopted as a board, and we're identifying projects within that we are implementing, and the implementation requires the adoption of board, but any changes to that implementation requires at a level of $1 million or more to report to the jurisdictions.
Yes, that's right.
And then beyond that, to make the reprogramming changes, we have the ability to move those funds, but if it's over $1 million, there will be communication with someone regarding those funds. And let me use the example of jurisdictional projects. There are things that happen regionally, but in this region, there may be a project in Virginia, and you find that it's not moving forward. If you want to change that allocation of funding to more efficiently move another project that's, let's say, moving in Maryland, the communication is going to be what and how?
The communication would be that, well, here's how it would work. So you'd have this assessment, project's not moving, we need to advance an existing project in the program. We would actually make recommendations to the general manager, Dave Kubitschek, or Jack Requa, depending, and would make recommendations to the general manager, he would look at the criteria that's established for that. So presumably, Mr. Sarles would look at, you know, the ability to perform within the criteria. Does it meet the prioritization process? And presumably it would because it's in the program. Our ability, does it need new resource? I mean, all sorts of criteria. And he would probably look at the regional impact to some extent. I would assume he would look at that. And once he'd make that decision, he would actually provide that notification to the board that this is his recommended, this is what he will be doing. His decision, right? It's not a request for approval, but it'll be, this is the decision that's been made. And so that selection criteria, he will go through and then provide that notification to the board.
And I assume, since the majority of our capital program is embodied in federal grants that are federally funded, which are line itemed according to project, you're still bound by the FTA grant amendment process.
Yes, and actually that's a great comment, because not only are we bound by, you know, you can't use CMAQ grants, for example, to do a rail rehabilitation line. So some of the work that happens prior to the recommendation going to Mr. Sarles is identifying the color of money, if you will, and making sure it's appropriate use, so that you're not taking, you know, a bus, CMAQ funds is a great example, moving it to a rail, because obviously we cannot do that. The other requirement that restricts us to some extent is the fact that the FTA with the PREA funds has requested that pre-approval of projects prior to them being, you know, approved by the board. So if we change projects that are funded by PREA, we actually have to notify the FTA administrator before doing that. So there's a lot of work that goes before we get to that decision that Mr. Sarles would make.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nichols and then Ms. Hines.
Thank you. A couple of questions specific to the capital funding agreement, the notification, and the implications of funding from the jurisdictions. You drew a distinction between notifying versus approving. So with respect to the capital funding agreement, if it is more than $1 million in change of a specific project, then you're obligated under the capital funding agreement to notify the jurisdiction, but not obligated to get an approval. And would you, the obligation would be to notify every jurisdiction, or just universal, every jurisdiction would be notified, and to the extent that there are maybe implications in funding requirements associated with the jurisdictions, what's the process for managing through that, or tell me how that process extends?
So in the capital funding agreement, it's purely a notification that goes to the jurisdictions if it's over $1 million.
Okay.
In terms of the second part of your question was a funding impact.
Right. I mean,
but I'm not.
Are there any other implications of, yeah, to the jurisdictions associated with the capital funding agreement other than just now I'm aware? Operationally, what are any implications that may arise within a jurisdiction and its funding obligations to support the execution of projects?
Right. And there should be no funding impact, because the funding impact, there's a commitment for, is it?
The 6 year, but it's the Form Ministry Advisory.
Okay, I'm asking. So, Matt, it's a 6 year program, but we're committed,
right,
for the first three. And that's
we adjust the allocations depending on the types of projects every three, according to the operating budget formulas. So the formulas are rejiggered, if you will, every 3 years based on the mix of projects, but they're set for 3 years. So there would be no impact on to the jurisdictions on funding, on the contributions.
So to the extent that you're moving forward a project and changing a funding obligation, that obligation would be within an expected range of funds that jurisdiction would be aware might be called upon. Correct.
It would be within the approved budget, the total amount of the approved budget, and the jurisdictional contributions that had already been laid out.
So we would not be, and I see your point, we would not be putting more obligation onto a jurisdiction outside of the plan. That would be one of the selection criteria we'd have to assume.
That's the question I was inartfully asking.
Yeah, no, that's all right. I was having a hard time inartfully answering. I apologize.
It's okay. It's a lot of art to go around.
Yeah. Thanks, Madam Chair. My experience in these things is that our best shot as a board is in understanding what the criteria are and those being clear and transparent to us that the manager will use in making the decision. That's where our policy focus should be, is that these are the things that go into the decision. So my request would be that you all think a little bit about writing up a one-pager that clarifies to us the operating documents you already have, the CFA, the FTA requirements, and all of that, so that's very clear to us, and then sort of lay out the criteria the manager will use, and then what that means for us. I think that will help us understand this more clearly and leave a better track record, actually, for the future. I have two other questions to sort of focus on. In that scenario that I gave you where something else has to move so that fiscal year 14 project can come up, is, in your thinking about this, is the manager required to also say to us, and here's what I think the new game plan is about the project that I'm basically reprogramming from, or is that question left in limbo?
Well, part of the evaluation will be, and we do this on a monthly basis, is, you know, where are you in your project? Have you met your performance milestones? So we're anticipating that we will know way in advance that a project is not going to, perform at its performance. And so that's the opportunity, not waiting to the last minute,
sure,
right? Waiting until the beginning of the first quarter of the year, saying, okay, we've got a project that now is going to leak into the next year. And so that's when the opportunity would be made to move projects around. So there'll be two assessments. One assessment is on why the project is being moved out to the next year, and reevaluating that criteria and making sure the project manager, you know, we understand. And then the new criteria, new projects being actually advanced, and making sure that we have all the right criteria within that as well in order to perform it. So you're not going to switch a project unless you're very clear that performance can be done in terms of what the goals are for the year.
Right, and I guess I asked my question inartfully as well, which is that project that isn't likely to perform.
Yes.
When the manager tells us, I'm making this reprogramming move within my authority, is the manager also saying, and this project, we're moving out?
The recommendation is going to come actually from PB and from the project manager and Dave Kubicek. And that's really, that's going to be a very concerted effort among those three. Because you will have a tendency of project managers to say, I know I can perform.
Right.
I mean, so really, we've got a structure in place that we're making sure that if you're not performing, you know, you've got to go through a whole litmus test of things, why, and it's a regular structure that happens here.
Right.
So maybe just to add to that, it's going to be clear what project is not performing, which means it's stretching out, or the project could be performing very well and we're coming under estimate.
Right.
That would be the nice part.
Wouldn't that be nice?
And as a result, then we will match up some project that is in the out years that we can advance in, and that's what we'll advise the board. So you'll see a tie between the two.
So we'll see both pieces,
yeah.
Not just the
yeah.
thing being accelerated,
right.
But the other, where the money is coming from.
Yeah.
And then just going to Mr. Nichols asked this, you told us it's a three-year average that you're using to figure out what our subsidy would be. If there were to be a major swing, say, from Virginia to one of the others in this three-year period, then in the next three-year period, we catch up? Is that what is that how it works?
If I may, the allocation is not based on the location of the project. It's based on the type of the project, so bus and rail,
okay.
and access. So there wouldn't be shifts if, you know, for example, if the bus garage was funded in Virginia and we instead built one in Maryland, that kind of shift wouldn't
okay.
occur. And the way the capital funding agreement is set up is that expenditures through that third year are based on the formula that's set forth. It's actually the FY10 subsidy formula. And then expenditures after that period would be on the updated subsidy formula.
Okay. Thanks. That's helpful.
Let's sit down.
First, I want to say I totally support the change in delegations. I have a concern. First, the reference to the JCC as the trigger at $1 million worth of change does not mention an obligation to the board.
No, it doesn't.
it should.
I agree.
We are still the governing body. I don't mind it being a joint notification of the board and the JCC, but I don't think a delegation should list and report to others than the board preliminarily. Second, I'm more concerned about improving transparency of the decisions that are made. I think a commitment to posting to the website of changes made, not just to the board and to the jurisdictions, help the public understand that we are dependent on their trust for the decisions that we make. And I think there are ways that the general manager could commit to that kind of transparency about the use of his discretion. I think that's particularly important about the item we have not discussed at all, and that is the bottom one on the chart, which is operating budget reprogramming transfers. And the GM CEO authorized to reprogram operating budgets as long as total budget is not increased. I think those reprogrammings are particularly important about public disclosure in a very timely fashion so that people can track this delegated decision-making process. And it requires more thought and more commitment to outreach and to transparency than I see here in this document right now.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Mr. Acosta.
Thank you. I'm also very supportive of this effort, but in my agency, my commission has delegated a number of items to me to execute. So every time I do that, I'm required to report out a one-pager, which basically explains the rationale and the criteria that I use to delegate, which we publish and release to both the commission as well to the general public. And it seems to me that a very simple way to do this is to, when you, you know, come up with your criteria that Ms. Hines asked for, is also produce a format that we can look at that you'll commit to. So every time you exercise this delegation, which assumes you've made the decision already, but it's posted, it's transparent. And also there's a paper trail that could be audited so we understand over time what the cumulative impacts have been. And I think that's important for both record keeping as well as for our own sake. So I would encourage you to perhaps, or I would like to ask you to bring that back actually at the next meeting. So we have some assurances that there is good record keeping made of these delegations.
Mr. Nichols, do you have another comment?
Yes, just one question, and I'm very supportive of this. I think it's very important to do. It will help manage the organization. Clearly, the reporting to the board, being certain that we're getting the timely quality reports that have been amplified here, I think is very, very important. The question that I have and is just a little bit more information in terms of background. I think this is part of what some of the briefings that you had earlier in the year. But Parsons Brinkerhoff and their role, clarify for me their current and their ongoing role in terms of building and supporting the infrastructure, and to the extent that their role is not long-term, what's our process for strengthening, and satisfying ourselves that the infrastructure, the people, the training, the policies, the procedures are in place before they disengage from the process? Talk to me about that so that we're comfortable. Or if that's the way it works.
There's two major purposes in having PB, some outsider on board. One role, which I think will be a continuing role and should continue forever, is to serve as an oversight role and provide to the board some independent evaluation as to how we're progressing as staff on the capital program, scope, schedule, budget, that sort of thing from a programmatic viewpoint. That should continue forever. The other part was, as I mentioned earlier, that capital program management function had basically been dismantled here. They are bringing in staff to help us supplement existing staff and also, frankly, bringing in more modern techniques to help us manage the reporting systems, better scoping of projects, better estimating of projects, all those things. Even in the procurement area, we've had staff added. That is where, over time, we will replace, and we are in the hiring process, and I've already done some of that in some areas, we will replace consultant staff with employee staff so that they will have an opportunity to take on, and staff will be responsible for it. They will use the more modern techniques as well as be well-trained, and those are the ones that will that consultant staff will disappear over time. I don't have an exact thing because this is like peeling the onion, but it's, you know, probably in the nature of 1 to 2 years, something like that.
So Parsons, thank you. That's very, very helpful to me in terms of my understanding. But Parsons is building the infrastructure for managing the reporting up. They are, at least partially, for the short term, actually staffing the reporting and project management reporting for this aspect of it. And then they are also developing the policies and procedures and will do the training of our own staff that will be taking that process over. Is that part of their full role?
Yeah, but I want to go beyond that. It's not just providing the project reporting. They are actually helping us turn out the contracts, turn out the
project
projects
management
at this point.
Okay.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Ms. Hines and then Mr. Dam.
There's another element in this one that we've been talking about, the 5% cumulative, that I just want to make sure we're tuned into and the board. I'm looking at page 3, or it's actually page 91 of our packet, which is the draft resolution. Mm-hmm. And in that top resolved in the fourth bullet, which is the longer description of the 5%, it says that the GM will seek additional reprogramming authority to cover additional reprogramming amounts in increments which he shall determine to increase the total authority in increments thereafter. And I'm questioning whether we're being set up to have the general manager identify those or whether the board is going to have the authority to set those additional increments.
But you're getting the cap.
The purpose of this is for the general manager to come and recommend to the board an increase in an increment. The board approves that increment. What this is avoiding, which was originally proposed by staff, is that it would be an automatic request for another $40 million. I said, that's nuts. We will take a look at what's required, forecast it to you, and if it's $20 million, it'll be $20 million. If it's $60 million, it'll be $60 million. But we'll justify why, and then the board will approve that increment or decide to do something else.
So rather than you determining, it would be you would recommend to the board, right?
That's fine.
I just think that's clarifying.
That's the key part. Yeah. Mr. Dowling.
Yeah, general comment with respect to both the contracting side and the reprogramming side. Like the others, I'm very much in support of this. I think it is taking the board out of a role that they don't belong in. It is giving the CEO the power to do what's necessary to run the place. I have two concerns, and I'm sure you can deal with them. One is assurance that nothing we're doing in that change would trigger a concern at the Federal Transit Administration that we're not inside their third-party procurement guidelines, particularly if we've just had a triennial review. I wouldn't like to hear 3 years from now that we're doing it wrong. And I don't believe they would have any concern, but I'd like to be sure that they're there. Mm-hmm. Second point, and I'm looking ahead at the chart in terms of cycle time and savings. I think it's terrific if we can save 4 weeks at the end of the process. That's 4 weeks sooner for getting the work done. I would be hopeful to hear that you are also looking at the 180 days that precede the 4 weeks and saying, how can we take time out of that process as well? Simply making this change is a great step forward, but it can't be the end of the process.
Yeah, on the first question, yes, in terms of the circulars 4220 and 510, which are the FTA kind of guidelines, they are in our procurement manual. As I said, we not only get audited on a triennial basis, but our outside auditors audit our procurement guidelines as well, and we have an inspector general, as you know. And then on the second point, yes, there are hidden, you know, benefits that we have not even, you know, indicated in here, which is the one that you just identified. Yes.
Yes.
Mr. Barnes.
Thank you. I want to join my colleagues who said that they will that they support this. I support it strongly. I think it's a good step in the right direction. I would go farther. I would have gone farther. I would have made the policy even a larger change than this one. I suspect we will find over the next year or two as we implement this new policy, assuming it's adopted, that we're still, as a board, making a lot of business decisions for the organization. Maybe I'll be wrong, but I would urge that my colleagues, with the suggested proposals, all of which I agree with, in terms of how we can get adequate information as to how the program is going forward, I would hope we would support it in the committee today and in the board in a couple of weeks.
Madam Chair, yes. I'm going to make a similar comment to the one I made about the operating budget. I think that there's a need for us to focus in on what are the financial oversight measures that make the most sense for us to be tracking. Things like why are we having change orders often drive projects. Time to get a contract on the street. The areas where you're trying to make improvements, if they become some of the board's monitoring information, we have a measure of did we go far enough, Mr. Barnes? Are we seeing patterns that raise concerns for us and lead us to want to have a different kind of conversation? Not to slow the thing down, but I think we have this appropriate oversight role, and we have to figure out a small band of things we would like you to tell us on a somewhat regular basis so we are doing that oversight without impeding what is an important flow of getting the work done.
Okay. Ms. Hampshire Collins. I get a chance to call that name off.
We're having a governance conversation. That's what I've been thinking about the whole time we've had this discussion, and I think it's important to note that it's important work that we're doing, and it's a major step, and it's an accomplishment, I think, for the board and for management. I think the difficulty is that we are expected to be fiduciaries and to ensure oversight, and at the same time, we know we need to delegate major decision-making to management to do it. It requires, of course, I think it clearly says we trust management, that we're really willing to make this decision. But I think part of it is that sometimes, particularly when it involves the public and government money, boards are forced to engage in activity that looks like it's oversight, but is it really adding value? And so I think this is important work that we're doing, and it's sort of been the presumption as this conversation has gone on, but I think it's important to say. This is about governance. This is about a major move and transformation in our governance. And I think it's going to be a process that's going to rise and fall on the consistency in reporting, the substance of the reporting, and the comfort level that decisions are made consistent with expectations. But I think it's an important day for this organization.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, want to keep moving?
Well, how do we get there? Oh, okay. Well, actually,
we're moving.
Okay, the end. No, let's go back to. Well, here we are. So I'll just spend. We've actually had a lot of discussion about this already. So I don't want to reiterate it, other than to tell you maybe a point that we hadn't made. And I make this point often. You know, we are. You know, it's people, process, and tools, really. That's really what people, process, and technology. And we're dealing with the process, we're dealing with the people ramping up, and the technology piece is going to really enhance the reporting capabilities based upon the criteria that we established. And that actually has been a work in process for the last, you know, year, and we'll continue on. And so we have a lot of the point of these two charts is to assure you that those systems, from a technology point of view, we'll be capable of doing the reporting, regardless of what it is, for you to do your due diligence. So I'll just make that statement, and we can move on. So we've kind of already talked about the time savings. The one piece that I will talk to is the last chart, which we had not really discussed. Keep moving. There we go. So Here are some what we call non-procurement activities. And as I mentioned before, we have a procurement policy manual which guides us in our procurement for the authority, for everything, contract services, materials and supplies and parts. We have also utilized that procurement manual to guide us in some of these non-procurement activities. So it showed us ultimately almost two flaws. One is we really need to have a policy manual that addresses these non-procurement activities. And then we ended up listing what they are. And as you can see here, we bucketed it into about four different areas: real estate, financial, and jurisdictional. And the GM Delegated Approval Authority for these activities, including in travel provided the activity, does not require board approval under the compact. So we wanted to list these activities and make you understand. Our recommendation is that we would require board approval for these. I mean, I would never commit the authority for a $500 million debt issue without notifying the board or asking for approval on that. So that's just something that we wanted to list, and here are some of them. We may have missed one or two, but predominantly this actually takes care of most of them. So these are things that the board should be looking at. Connection fees, we've had discussions on, debt issuance, any type of joint development and planning agreements that are actually negotiated with jurisdictionals or joint development partners, and we would bring that to the board for approval anytime we entered into those. And, okay, so to them, and then the recommendation.
I'm curious as to why the board would need to approve banking services.
We sort of lumped it in place. Banking services are really, I would consider to be our banked monies, our relationships with banks. We typically come to the board for lines of credit, and that would be an obligation of the board, but that would be under bonds. So banking services could be something that we can take a look at. It's really not something that I have gone to the board with recently. So
there is it's not our pay grade.
I agree. I totally agree. It actually is. We can take a look at those agreements if you like, and make sure we exclude them. Unless Carol O'Keefe can come up with an example, maybe I.
Just.
Yeah. Right, necessary.
Okay. All right. I assume if you're saying the things here will continue to come to us.
That's correct.
If we see them and say this isn't the kind of thing we should be looking at in the future, we could amend this.
That's another delegation. That's correct.
It might be worthwhile to just mark any of them that are compact requirements.
Yes, we will do that.
Like an asterisk or something, then we wouldn't ask every time why we have to do it.
Okay. Mr. Nicholson.
Just one brief ask as a part of the regularized reporting, indicating to the board the progress we're making in building the infrastructure and the competency for managing the reporting and the projects as we're transitioning from Parsons to our own staff, and at what point we get to satisfaction within our organization that we fully have the competency and the infrastructure to manage it. And I know that's a building process, but I'd like to be able to see our progress toward achieving that competency, and particularly having the policies, procedures, and satisfaction that we're doing it. Thank you.
Okay. With that, we have a recommendation before us, and is there a motion for the board?
So moved.
Okay. There's a motion. And second. And this discussion, please. This moves this to the board. And in the discussion, I'd like to comment that I think one thing we can say is there is an incomplete part, and that is we have shifted where our involvement is on the board, but we've changed our involvement. And I think Ms. Hines and a couple of others spoke to what things we want to have. And while I think we can move forward with this, but I think we'd like to come back and see what those
accountability tools are that we're going to look to see that we're getting there, that how we're measuring it. And I think I feel comfortable with this moving forward. I think the discussion has been very helpful and to clarify questions and concerns. But I think we're going to want to have clear those things that we know, the reporting, notification pieces, and all of those identified for us as part of this. I'm not sure your timing.
Well, I can make a recommendation. I think we can provide, well, I know, because we're working on it. We can provide you with something next week with respect to the decision criteria with which the general manager will make these decisions and the specific notification process that we would take and what that notification, the template that it would take the shape of as a straw man, and we can send that to the committee and the board next week. Yeah, pro forma reports. That's what I meant by a template. So it would be sort of a template as here's what we would be reporting on, and if there's things that I think I heard what you'd like to have reported on based on the discussion, we can make an attempt at deriving what that is. And we can provide that next week.
Okay. Madam Chair, I would also suggest that you look at beefing up some of the language in the resolution on the and using the word monitoring very formally, because that is one of the tasks of governance, and I think that should be there. I would also ask that the wording change we talked about on page 3
be
incorporated.
Is there an objection? Hearing none. Okay. With that, all those, did we get a motion on the floor? We did. Okay. All those in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much, staff. I think this is a good move for us and a time well spent. We have two information items, and we have a little time left. We have two more committee meetings, and I know I don't want to push us too far. I know yours is after lunch, but we are pushing close to lunch as it stands. Ms. Kissel, can we go through these?
I think I can do it relatively quickly.
As an information item quickly?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. So we wanted to provide the board with an update on our progress with regard to our fare collection system. Beside me, I have Greg Garback here, who is the program manager of this project. We've been looking at this project for the last year and a half with the Technology Review Committee. We have been reporting out to the Technology Review Committee. This is an opportunity to report to the board. If you go to the purpose, so I'll just briefly take you through where we are with our goals and objectives, just to have an understanding of that, where we are in development of our business case, where we are with some of the transit collaboration we've done, since this actually is a very big program that's happening transit-wide. Everyone is looking at replacing their fare collection systems to enhance customer service and improve reliability. And we'll talk a little bit about fare model that implicates that. So the program overview is really to replace our existing fare collection system. In the day that we had SmartTrip, it was great technology, still is today, but in reality, it's 15 years old. It utilizes old technology. Anytime we upgrade it, it's difficult because you're using old technology. It's difficult to upgrade. It's a closed system. It is a system that's owned by our vendor. So whenever we make changes to our fare model, tariff, or how customers want to pay, we actually have to go forward a whole system of regression testing, software development, you know, moving it out to the systems, our fare gates and bus garages. So the program goal, the system is looking at, the overview of this project is to replace the fare collection system, which means looking at our infrastructure, which sits in the system. So we have a proprietary software technology that is designed and customized in such a way that it works very effectively now with the gates and the bus fare boxes that we have. If you change your fare collection system, you have to take a look at the hardware and the infrastructure that you have in your system. It's just something that you have to do. So we look at our gates. We have about 800 gates. We have over 1,000 vending machines. So it's something, is part of our business case to replenish that. We're looking at replacing our central data systems, and I won't go through the whole thing, but basically it's software, hardware, and the way people pay that we would actually take a look at and replace. We would look at new technologies, website development, and we're doing that now, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But basically we're looking to move out of the magnetic stripe cards and going to more of a what we call contactless cards. Contactless cards, our smart trips are predominantly contactless, but not fully contactless. And when I say contactless, what we mean about that is going through a gate using your debit and credit card or a mobile phone application or whatever the technology is to actually pay and go through your gate and get on your bus bus and tap on the fare box and pay. So that's what we mean by contactless. Just to give you a sense on the program goals, we've had numerous customer focus groups to talk about this. We've reached out to our Riders Advisory Council and a lot of other of our ancillary advisory boards to the board, and we asked them, you know, what they want, and basically they want to have simplified way to use their fares, simplified way to pay. We need to look at reinvesting in our payment system. Not only is our software old technology and a closed proprietary system, which we don't have ability to change without costing us money, but we have gates in our system that are they're at the end of its useful life. They're 30 years old. They work. The shell works perfectly, the brown gates. But what happens is when you go through an overhaul, you have to actually change the components. And, again, you're dealing with old technology. So it's an opportunity for us to reinvest in new versus reinvesting in the old and bringing it to an overhaul. And that's the decision point that we're making as part of this business case. We're also looking to integrate our systems. Our systems, and I keep saying this, but they're not integrated. They're very, we're working to integrate them. But can you imagine having a fare payment system that links directly to your financial system? A fare payment system that directly to your scheduling system that you have for bus and for rail. So there's so many optimizations that you can make, as well as business intelligence on where your profitable routes are, where they're not. Those are the types of things that we're looking to do with a new fare payment system. So it's integrating to our major mission-critical systems into our fare payments. And, again, adopting new technologies for the ease and convenience. The next chart actually just gives you, we took this from a lot of our lovely press back here. And every time we have an issue in our system, they actually communicate it. And we've had issues. We've had bus rider issues in the most recent on our smart trip problems. We've had delays and glitches. Last year when we implemented Peak of the Peak, we've had delays with our system in that. We are just struggling with how to keep the technology up to date given the complexities of our tariff system. And when we change it, we have to actually make sure that we are able to have the capability to do that. So today's issues on the next chart. The fare payment, and I guess I'll make this statement because based upon the other chart too, the fare payment is the first touch that the customer sees and experiences in our system. We want to make it easy. And so the goal is to do that, make it easy, reliable, and collect the revenue that you require to do. So I went through this a little bit, but the aging equipment is very is significant, and it's in our business case. We're looking at the state of good repair currently. We're estimating that at $60 million. We've had an independent assessment done by LTK Engineering that's looked at primarily our gates and vending machines and have made that estimate for us to overhaul the existing. Again, we also have a strained capacity, and I've made the mention before, but about the proprietary technology that we really need to move out of. The benefits, I'll say that based upon some of the customer focus groups and some of the things that are happening actually outside of transit, allow us to look at that and say, gee, we can actually make sure that customers have more options to pay, whether it's debit or credit card or mobile phone apps, and utilize that technology in transit industries. We also are looking at the ability to be more efficient in our maintenance costs. If I have to overhaul a 30-year piece of equipment, or actually Dave's got to do that, but it's actually costly, and it's not efficient. And so if we are able to reinvest in new hardware and software, we do two things. You optimize your maintenance structure, you actually take advantage of warranty, you minimize your operating costs, and you move out the investment that you have to make on overhaul another 20 years. Those are all good things that make a very good business case and identify what your 6-year or 7-year or 8-year payback is for the investment that you're going to make. The other benefit here is, and it's on the next page, I'll go through it quickly, but it's on the bottom. We have looked in the industry at how we can optimize any new fare collection systems to identify new areas of revenue. And many areas, many folks have done this. In London, where they're implementing the contactless fare payment systems, they have co-partnered with Barclays Bank, and they have actually generated advertising revenue as a result of that. Loyalty programs. Our neighbors at Amtrak actually have established a very a good loyalty and branding program that has accumulated about $22 million over the last few years to their revenue base. So those are things that we can take a look at in the transit industry and identify how we can actually use that to offset some of the costs that we would have to invest in a new program. So now I get to the numbers, which, and I know it's a busy chart, but I'm going to try to do this simply. We've looked at what it costs us to collect revenue in our system. So it's revenue, it's maintenance of the hardware, maintenance of the software, it's the coin collections, the counting, the labor, parking operations, and if you can see total current expenses, it probably is 11 and it goes out to 21, goes from $48 million a year to $57 million a year. That's just our operating costs to collect and just distribute fare media, magnetics, smart trip cards, and we get software, hardware. That's the operating costs that we have to do this. If we look at a business case to replace our fare collection system, one of the areas we look at is operational efficiencies. So how much does it cost you to collect a dollar, and how can you get efficient in that? One of the concepts of the business case is revenue optimization. One of the things that we've looked at on a regular basis is fare avoidance, fare collection avoidance, I will call it. It could be fare evasion. It could be fare collection avoidance due to systems. And we have that. It can run anywhere from $2 million a year to upwards of $7 million a year or $10 million a year. We actually put it in ranges. With a new system that you have, potentially if you're putting in new turnstiles, you have the ability to do two things. Collect your revenue more efficiently because now you have a more efficient exit and entry possibly in your system, as well as having the software, the capability for collecting your revenue. We would no longer be an issuer of fare media and distribution. We would rely on the bank cards to be that issuer, and we'd have agreements with them in order to collect our revenue. So there's ways to optimize your revenue collection, and these are not new ideas. They're actually being done in London and in Canada and in some other areas, but they're just new to the domestic market. We're in line with Chicago, with MTA, and with SACEPTA in actually developing these business case as an industry standard. The operating savings is really where you get most of your efficiency as you develop new systems. You actually cut them in half if you go to FY21. So $57 million in operating costs that you have now would be cut in half, more than half actually, because you're actually having you're getting out of that fare distribution business. You're having the bank cards, the ability for the bank cards to do your fare media and collect that revenue and provide that to us. So that's the basis of the operating business case. On the capital side, this is in two parts. On the capital side, the current program, as you can see on the program total, these are the programmed amounts that we currently have in our CIP. These are things we must do now in order to stand up our legacy system. We must overhaul our bus fare box. We must continue the parking credit card operation. We must continue to develop the payments to NextFair 5 Cubic in order to deliver the enhancements that we've contracted with them for. So we still have to do those types of things. We also are investing in some of our fare vending update and some of our currency processing machinery now. The things that we would do below, we would also have to do. We'd also have to invest in the state of good repair on our gates. As I said before, the shells are great. The paddles don't work all the time. The components need to be overhauled. So that investment on rail as well as on bus would be, net program total would be a $60 million, the $59.7 million total there. Currently, that's not programmed in our state of good repair six-year CIP. The opportunity to program that would be this fall when we actually re-look at our six-year capital program and reprioritize where we want our investments to be. But that $60 million would be invested in the old equipment that we have now. That's the premise. The new business case, which is the AFC, the next chart.
Madam Chair. Just, I have a question about these charts, because I understand in the package that a phase-in period of time for this might be FY 14 to 17. And when I look at the numbers on this chart, of course, you know, there's gradual drop-offs through that period. So is this chart and the previous chart consistent with a parallel running of the smart trip technology and the new technology and your anticipated phase out? Is that what these numbers
reflect?
That's
exactly what it is. So the concept is to phase out your smart trip program and to phase in your new program. They would have to work in parallel, and so you would have a transition. And there's a lot of considerations. I mean, presumably one primary consideration is, what do you do with people who are unbanked, who do not have debit and credit cards? That's a real situation for us, and we're looking at that now as part of this business case. How do you deal with that demographic of people? How do you ensure that they have the fare media appropriate to get on your bus or on your rail? So it presumes, as you say, a transition period that would ultimately converge in the out years, where you have everyone moved over out of Smart Trip and into a more flexible form of payment.
So you've been able to estimate the rate at which you think that would happen based on others' experience, or how did you kind of determine that? Because, you know, this, when you look at the very, you know, very first page of it, it talks about the, I guess on page 107, it says complete replacement of the existing fare collection system. And I don't want anyone to be led to believe that, you know, one day you're just going to switch over.
Right.
And I mean, this is a long phased-in process where customers would have an opportunity for a period of time to do what they're comfortable with.
Yes.
And so I just want to make sure I understand, when you're phasing down these numbers, you base that on an anticipated action that customers will take to transition. And is that a fair number based on what others have experienced?
It's a number based upon what we see in the industry. So we have close connections with SEPTA, who is currently going through and negotiating with a vendor who they've selected, speaking with Chicago Transit, of course, then in Canada as well. So it's, again, it's people, process, and technology. And anytime you move those three things, it's not an easy thing. And the purpose of this is really just to give you a look on what the pro forma business case is, your point. It's not, hey, this is where we're going. This is actually a process. And the process is not meant to be exclusive of our customers at all. It's meant to be meant to notify, you know, communicate the board, communicate to our riders where we are in the process of estimating what the benefits will be and how we can get there. So it is going to be a very inclusive process to make sure that we actually provide, you know, get the right business case in place. That's the first step. As we go through the RFP process, and we actually are doing a phase two at the end of this month, there's going to be a lengthy process with negotiating with whoever the vendor is that we select to make sure that we've accommodated for all the performance metrics that we want in this contract. I will say that with our current partner that we have, Cubic, it is not a performance contract, basically. So the lessons learned on this is great, because we've been able to learn what doesn't really work and what we can do to make it work now, because really what our customers want are performance. And if our customers want performance, that is how we have to negotiate any change in our system with our new partner.
Ms. Kissel, let me have Mr. Wells ask his question, and then I think we need to go to the accomplishment piece and where we want to go with this.
We will.
And so we can get there.
Just a quick statement, I guess, that the decision that we make in terms of whether it's a closed system or an open system for payment doesn't just impact how what's best practice of transit systems, but it also has a lot to do, I think, with the policy decisions that we make as governments and how people participate economically with being able to make payments in a lot of different ways. And so what I would hope is that we have a process that really is open enough to match the policy decisions of our jurisdictions on whether we go to an open or closed type payment participation system.
Yes, and we that is the intent to do that. And we have reached out with some of the entities that I mentioned before, customer focus groups, riders advisory councils. But you're right, we need to actually have more detailed discussions with our jurisdictional partners, because there's a lot of considerations. There could be a consideration that says, let's not even invest in all this technology on bus. Let's just call it a day and make all bus free.
Well, no,
I mean,
again,
think about it.
I mean, that's
an alternative that
a lot
something
of our,
you would look at.
A lot of jurisdictions are facing figuring out how to do kind of payment forward on a lot of stuff.
That's right.
And so how to fully participate, not just in transit. And so what I want to encourage you again is find a way to and I help participate in that if you like, but to look at how our governments are planning forward to the next 5 to 10 years so that for the unbanked, and also people that make a choice about being unbanked, of how they're going to participate economically with their own financial
and
systems.
And we work closely with Octo in the district, with the DC One card. So you're absolutely right. These actually have regional implications. So we work very closely with MTA, working closely with Virginia, because it will have a regional implication, and we have to understand what those planning concepts are. I will tell you that it's been very positive in terms of trying to move in the direction to replace.
I'm very supportive of moving forward. It is time to change. As we move forward, what I would hope we would see is understanding that we don't have a customer. We have a variety of classes of customer.
Yes.
We have people who ride once and never come back. We have people who park who don't park. We have people who use different modes. We have people who are technologically proficient and people who are technologically unskilled. We have school children, we have social service recipients. We need to have, as we move forward, a clear picture of those many classes of user, how they will pay their fare, how they pay it today, how they will be treated during the transition, so you don't have to have 5 different forms of payment and where we're headed eventually, but never say we're dealing with the customer.
Yeah, Mr. McKay, myself, and former board member Benjamin for the last couple of years have actually been very sensitive to that issue. I would add students to that because, you know, students certainly many times don't have credit cards, although today they do have, but many don't. So that we're very sensitive to that, and I think I'm glad Mr. Wells and Mr. Downey brought that up because that is a concern of ours, and we've been monitoring that very closely.
Okay. So, Okay, so I'm just going to go right to page 119. Oh, yes. Okay, sorry.
You've listed the completed step one process of the 29th of April.
Yes.
And you've issued step two documents on the 30th.
Yes.
Transparency about the procurement process. If you've made the decision about the people who have proposed for phase one and have been in effect, let go from this process, mm-hmm. needs to be a public process. The other is that a comment that if we're bringing step two documents forward at the end of this month, then step two proposals in September, that there be an agenda of the review of this, given all of our interest in this, mm-hmm. for both the July and the September board meetings for finance. That this needs to be an ongoing
conversation with the board and for public exposure.
I agree. On the accomplishments to date, actually, the phase one, we did qualify. It was a qualifying round, and we did qualify seven vendors, which are listed on the prior chart. ACS, Accenture, CSC, our current partner, Cubic, IBM, and the Revere Group. So all very big players in the transit industry. Some are new to fare collections, and some are not. But they all have one thing in common. They're all technology systems integrators, which is very different from the business model that we implemented in the 90s, which is really we selected an equipment manufacturer. So the new process is to look at systems integrations. Commodity hardware is really just a commodity that you can buy anywhere. And this is apparent with how we talk about our smart trip cards, right? We have the specialized chip in the smart trip card, which we do not have any inventory for. I mean, we have enough to go through the next year and a half, and we'll be replacing that with a commodity chip in the next year. So you don't want to ever get into that, tied up into that issue with having specific hardware. You want to have hardware as a commodity. The value is in the systems integration. So I'll go quickly to the next steps. On the next chart, it really just talks about step two, which is the system requirements proposal, and we're in phase to initiate that in a couple of weeks. There'll be a very strenuous evaluation and negotiations that occur over time, and it will be inclusive, and I do agree that it needs to be talked about in public and at subsequent board meetings as we go along. We actually are we have subject matter experts in-house, Greg and his team. We have LTK, and we also are looking at some financial advisors and technology advisors to help complement the team to help us in the negotiation. So that's being set up as I speak. And then just one thing on the transit leadership, and this is important because a lot of transits, a lot of the major ones are going through this as well. So we meet on a regular basis. Actually, they're coming here on June 14th to discuss. And if I have to leave you with one concept, it's this, that the transits together are looking to define what the system requirements are for fare collections in their entities instead of having it defined by a vendor. And that is a very big sea change, and we have actually leverage in that respect because we do understand now what our system requirements are because we have been listening to our customers. And that's that's the model that we're actually basing this whole thing on. One thing I will mention before I go is the new revenue and ridership model. We have an opportunity, and this has already been kicked off by my team. They're evaluating our revenue model now, taking a look at it, taking a look at how people pay, the structure of the model, the economics of the model, the way it looks, the demographics of our riders, and to build a new model. And the opportunity is there is when you build a new model that will be delivered to the board can look at this in terms of making decisions in terms of revenues and fare policy that will effectuate and impact your new fare collection system. If you make your system complicated, it will just make the payment aspect complicated. So we're linking the two, and it's very important that we do that. So that's being kicked off as well. And I'll end there because it's probably a good spot.
Chair. Two quick things. One is, in thinking about your step two, I wonder if you could provide us sort of the big ideas that you are promoting as part of this system. Again, it would just be really helpful, being relatively new. And then the second thing goes to the last thing that you put up, that you're looking at the fare structure and all of that. I went to the Accessibility Advisory Committee this week. They are thinking already what they want to tell us about that. This is an area where I think we should invite our major stakeholder groups to tell us what they're looking for, too, so that, because I think the board, that would be very helpful to the board.
And I will tell you, Ms. Hines, they are already included. I hope Christian Kent made that statement, but they will be included in this because they, too, are looking at fair policy. So we're reaching, it was a big outreach on this piece of it, the revenue and fair policy, because it affects everybody, and it needs to be inclusive. So they are being interviewed by some of the consultants we have, as well as the in-house staff, to get their
recommendations and feedback on that
right,
as well.
And if the groups want to make, you know, a concerted statement to us, I guess what I'm saying is I think the board would invite them to share whatever, wherever they collectively come to, as well as their individual feedback to.
And I just want to comment on that. Besides getting advice from the advisory committees, we also do a lot of customer research on this so that we try to cover the broad span of our customers in addition to what the advisory committees come up with.
And I just want to clarify that where are we with the JCC on this and how much involvement are they going to have? Because, of course, the jurisdictions have a big investment in Smart Trip Card and want to make sure that, you know, their issues are addressed as well. I think this is fabulous. I think it's way overdue. I think we need to go this route. But I just want to make sure that the coordination is also happening with the JCC, because all these jurisdictions have investments in the existing fair media system we have.
Well, there's been a regional coordination. As you know, we have a regional agreement that's not populated by the JCC with our partners, and we've been engaging in discussions with them about it. But we are scheduled to have a full presentation to the JCC on July 24th for this. So that's what's going to happen. I'm not June. Did I say July? Yeah. It's June. A few weeks. Okay.
This is a very big step. So it will be coming up more frequently to us, so I look forward to our next presentation. I am going to refer the financial report to the board for their reading and questions to staff if you have any at this time. If not, then we can move forward to the next committee meeting. Are there any questions regarding? I think I'm going to ask that we commend it to your own reading today. And if you have questions, you can ask outside.
I will say that on the monthlies, just I think Mr. Sars will make some statements about that at the board meeting, right. So in anticipation of the year-end close.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. If there are no other business, I'd ask that we adjourn this meeting, and I will turn this over to customer service.